The Loose Cannons Podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
For love is all there is, and you are cannon fodder in its defense.
Hey everyone, another Loose Cannons podcast coming at ya, continuing our discussion of black filmmakers for African American History Month here in the U.S. We're going to be discussing 1973's Ganja and Tess, directed by Bill Gunn, a film about vampires. But before we do that, let's do this. Does anyone have any heralds and denouncements? Patrick.
Yes, I will herald a movie that I watched this morning, and that was Super Cop, or Police Story Part 3, with Jackie Chan and Michelle Yeoh. It's still as much fun, and the action is still great as I remember it. It was part of my like massive rewatching project that I was doing, and I enjoyed it a lot.
Did you watch the dubbed version or the subtitled?
The dubbed version, actually. The dubbed version was what I saw originally, so I was like, well, and it's also what's on Netflix, so
yeah.
I was like, I'll take that.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of the Police Story sequels because it's really hard to find them subtitled, and I'm super stickler about that.
Yeah, but I still enjoy it, like... It's the kind of movie where I'm like, I don't care if they sound kind of goofy with their overdubbed voices. Like, you know, it's that kind of an action movie.
Sure. I'm excited to watch it, though. I like me some Jackie Chan.
Yeah, I want to revisit the Jackie Chan films that I have seen now and then watch some new ones.
Rumble in the Bronx is amazing.
Yeah, that's another one on my rewatch list.
It has an awesome Barry Lyndon-esque scene where someone is describing, you know, a really sad thing happening, and I laugh really hard.
Uh-huh. It's super hard not to. I'm laughing again, just imagining it.
Basil?
Yeah, I would like to herald Jordan Belson's Allures, because of this avant-garde cinema class that I've been taking. I've been watching a bunch of pretty crazy stuff, and my favorite of the stuff we've watched so far is this movie, which is sort of just a trance movie. It's all animated, but it plays a lot with sort of hypnotic effects of film and a lot of flashing. Some of it's super intense, and some of it is really soothing, and I think it's one of the first sort of abstract avant-garde movies that I've seen where when it was over I was like sort of sad that it was over. I was like, that was 8 minutes, and that was really great 8 minutes. I could have watched that for an hour probably. It just felt really comforting and also stimulating at the same time in a really interesting way, so I like that a lot.
I would like to denounce the movie Compliance. I don't know if anyone watched it.
I heard it was bad.
It's one of the worst movies I've seen in a long time. It's like based on that terrible story of this person who impersonates a police officer on the phone and makes a manager of a McDonald's do terrible things with one of her one of the employees, including letting her strip naked and then have a man babysit her while she's naked, and then the man ends up doing like horrible things to her. And it's just like a gonzo porn version of a reality show, which with like mainstream film credibility, and it's horrible. In each, like, if this was just like a straight up porno movie, I would have, I guess, understood what it was trying to do better. Otherwise, it does not add anything to the story that you could read just on Wikipedia. It basically just repeats all the things that you can read there, except in graphic detail and very gross. So, yeah. Do not watch that movie unless you want to feel really angry for the rest of the day.
Yeah, I heard it was really shameless and just super sleazy.
Yeah.
So I skipped it.
Mm. Good. Good job.
It's too bad. It's a movie about how someone just impersonating the police can have power. It's an interesting concept, which was in Let's Be Cops as well, and that one was also sleazy and shameless.
Yeah.
It should be a horror movie concept, but...
Yeah, for sure.
I have a Herald, based on the recommendation of fellow Loose Cannons member Patrick Williams. I watched the movie Drug War.
Yeah.
I started watching it at work, and I was like, oh no, I'm not going to like this because it's like really evenly lit and blue, and I didn't like the look of it. And it turns out that not liking the look of it didn't really matter because this movie's pretty much great in every other way that a movie can be great. It's ostensibly an action movie, but you know, I don't want to give too much away, but it pretty much undercuts everything that you would sort of expect from an action movie, like sort of some of the things that I got from John Wick that I discussed about in the Best of 2014 podcast are done even better than Drug War in terms of like frustrating your expectations and like what you would like to happen. I just say that like it, you know, there's a point at which a bad guy can sort of get away. And I couldn't tell, like, I couldn't decide whether or not I wanted to root for him to get away because he was a human, or if I wanted him to suffer because he had done so many bad things. And, like, it just made me, like, really uncomfortable and sad. Because normally I feel like that decision is super clear for you in most movies.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm super excited about it. Johnny Toe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm excited about that too. After his appearance on our Best of 2014.
That's true, but with a different movie.
Yep.
I'm excited to watch some of his like romantic comedy looking films, because most people tend to stick to one genre. So the fact that he makes these movies that look like... I don't know, like South Korean soap opera covers or something. It's really intriguing to me.
I've seen at least one of, I've seen two of them actually, and I remember them being pretty good. I haven't seen them in like 7 or 8 years. One of them is super bad, but I think maybe I watched three of them. One of them involves the same couple. I think all three of them do, and in one of them they're both wearing fat suits, and most of the jokes are just about them being fat, and that's not very good. But the other two that I remember seeing, I remember liking a lot.
Okay.
Well, I forgot all about those just now.
Let's move into this podcast. Today's selection, as I already mentioned, is Ganjan Hess, which was Ilya's pick. So he is going to give us a plot description.
Okay. So Ganjan Hess is ostensibly the story of a man called Hess Green, who works as an anthropologist and I think also an archivist in a museum. He does research on an ancient African tribe which had been destroyed by a blood disease 10,000 years before Egypt. And we also know that we know about him is like he's an elegant, sophisticated man, judging by his clothing and his mansion and his Rolls Royce that he drives around. Early in the movie, he is stabbed by an assistant of his with a ceremonial dagger, after which he
a patient much, of his.
Pretty much becomes a vampire. Is he his patient or is he his assistant? I don't really remember exactly. Maybe he's patient, yeah.
His wife says that he's seen when they talk on the phone.
Yeah.
That you're treating my husband or something.
Yeah, that's George Mita, played by Bill Gunn himself, the filmmaker and director and writer of this movie. He stabs Hess Green, and after which Green becomes a vampire and immortal. And after Mita shoots himself, Hess Green drinks his blood and keeps him in a refrigerator in his house. When Mita's wife comes to visit him, she discovers her ex-husband in that house, but then still ends up marrying Mr. Hess Green and also becoming a vampire. So they become lovers. There is, like, yeah, I'm not sure exactly how much plot there really is after that, but you see Mr. Green visit his son, who's attends a boarding school and speaks French. And you also see him attack various people throughout his life. His bloodlust is shown as a kind of through this kind of stinging sound on the soundtrack, and is like sound which sounds kind of like a drill being drilled somewhere. And you kind of follow his story, and like in the main part of the movie, kind of deals between the relationship between Hess Green and Maida's wife, ex-wife Ganja. Yeah.
I like this movie. I think I respect it more than I like it. I think it's really interesting, and it brought up a lot of stuff that I'm discussing in my African aesthetics class that we'll get into. But there's also a lot of stuff that's like really uncinematic in a way that's not interesting at all. Like there's one part where Ganja and Maida are having a conversation, and Maida's like in a tree, and Ganja is like standing next to the tree, and then it's just one shot for like the whole conversation, and you can't really see either of their faces. And I'm like, this might be the most boring thing that I've ever looked at.
It's Hess and Maida. Ganja. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, Hess, the doctor. And there's like a noose in the tree, and I'm like, oh, this is going to get interesting. But then it never really does. It's like super hard to pay attention to what they're saying when the shot is like so intentionally uncinematic. But I did think it had a lot of cool stuff to say, and I guess we'll get into that later. Patrick?
I also like this movie. I was a little put off by what you were saying, the uncinematicness of it early in the film, but I felt like it, as it progressed, it got better at sort of showing up those cinematic moments, especially the part at the end where they're dealing with the cross and the part where he goes to church and all of that. I thought that church sequence did go on a little too long, but I ended up liking it just because of the way, I don't know, it felt natural, but also like it belonged in a movie at the same time. I really enjoyed Sam Wayman, who played the Reverend Luther Williams in this. I thought he seemed very natural. It seemed like he might actually be a preacher. And I did enjoy this movie a lot, and I enjoyed a lot of the things that it had to say, too. And I felt like it was a movie that challenged me in places that I felt were very intentional, and I felt, you know, very okay with being challenged on all the points that it threw at me. So, yeah.
I am not sure how I feel about this movie. If I had to pick, I guess I would say that I'm on the side of slightly disliking it, but I don't feel super comfortable with that. And that I agree that I thought that there was a lot of interesting stuff going on, and yet I felt like it was really hard to access most of that stuff, and a lot of what it was saying, it seemed like it was saying in a kind of oblique way that I found really impenetrable. So I was like, I don't know how to respond to this movie, but at the moment it's not pulling me in. I think it's funny that you said that though, Ruben, because that was one of the few shots where I was actually super into it, and I was really digging that shot. But I like the way that his legs are just lit up in like a weird way, and the way that he has to keep standing under the noose and then walking away from it and then standing under it again. I like that shot, but there are others that I liked less, and a lot of the movie, it felt like was a little bit intentionally hard to pay attention to or follow what was going on, and sometimes I liked that, but other times it was a little too frustrating maybe for me.
I agree that for me it was also pretty impenetrable at times. I kind of enjoyed that, and I like the fact that I was watching a movie that did things that I had not or was not used to movies really doing that much, and that I felt it was like a commentary on various things, but like the most interesting was how it kind of inverted like blaxploitation tropes and played with expectations that maybe you would have going into it in a way that was very that kind of challenged me, which I liked. And I was never really sure how it even felt about some of the topics it was talking about, like religion, like class or aristocracy or things like that, and how vampirism was used as a metaphor for addiction, and but what exactly it was trying to say about it. So while I agree with you that was like at times kind of purposefully oblique about it, I really like that. So yeah, I like this movie.
What blaxploitation tropes, maybe could you give an example?
Mm-hmm.
And how it subverted them. I don't know blaxploitation that well.
So in a way I would say having a handsome black man at the center of its story in the 70s, and having a very pretty looking woman at the other center of its story, and the movie being kind of explicitly about that relationship, the way it was about that relationship was actually quite weird. Like, it wasn't like, the way it portrayed sex was not very exploitative, I felt like, at all. And the way the main actor was, so Hess was supposed to be a protagonist, but he's like the least identifiable protagonist you could imagine. He's pretty much from the beginning, he's shown as like a monster who drinks blood. He's also extremely wealthy and speaks French and things like, which are probably not exactly things you would associate with a like macho black character from the 70s blaxploitation culture. Like, he's not Shaft, or he's not any one of those kinds of characters, and the way he isn't them I felt was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I also thought it was interesting that he is kind of an embodiment of white culture. He lives in a house that's full of all this European art, and it's made up of European architecture, and he's sort of trapped in this world of classical white culture, as opposed to blaxploitation, where the characters are usually streetwise guys who live in a city somewhere. This guy lives out in the country away from all of that. And
yeah, it's important that he speaks French specifically, because that was a nation that was known for assimilating the places that they colonized. So that's, you know, it. The fact that he's, I guess, French African American is meaningful in a way that that he can aspire to whiteness in a way in which Americans can't.
For sure.
Yeah. Also, I guess you could say that in a way, at heart, a lot of so-called black exploitation films were pretty conservative in what they were trying to say, like the way who was perceived to be evil or bad in black exploitation movies were, you know, drug dealers or criminals, and the heroes, either they're like Shaft on the side of the law, or they are somehow mistreated by drug dealers such as like Pam Grier and fight back against them. In this movie, there were no real, like, Hess Green is not fighting crime, or he's not in any kind of side of the law. If he is, he's kind of living beyond it, just through being an immortal. But the way that this movie was trying to just show this person who is not really, couldn't really be classified as good or evil, or that even cared that much about being good or evil.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I feel like if you take the concept on paper, if you were like, hey, do you want to watch this blaxploitation movie? It's about this dude and a woman who are vampires. But I feel like a lot of people would be like, oh, do they, like, run around and, like, kill a bunch of white people and drink their blood, like, getting revenge for slavery or something? And I feel like that's the kind of narrative that happens a lot in a lot of blaxploitation movies, of, like, you know, sassy talking, like, badass people who are, like, fighting back or whatever, and that this is sort of an interior story where there's almost no white characters at all and just deals with the kind of internalized racism and other ideas like that is a little bit subversive of the genre.
Well, the marks of white supremacy, yeah, are a lot more subtle in this movie. Like, one of the big conflicts, I guess, is that the pull between, like, I guess, an older African religion and, like, Christianity, and the idea that, like, so I thought this was I hadn't seen vampires like this before, like, in the sense that blood is almost always about, like, sex or passion or money, like, in vampire tales, like, that's what they're, you know, taking advantage of. But in this case, like, blood is actually specifically about blood rituals, and the fact that in African religions they would do actual blood rituals, whereas in Christian Western religion they do metaphorical blood rituals, and the idea that, like, him becoming a vampire in a way is him going back to his roots, which is very strange because vampires are normally villains. But it's seen kind of, like, weirdly positive in this movie, like, that something is missing, and what's missing is the drinking of blood.
Yeah, I thought what you were saying about internalized racism is interesting too, Basil. I wrote down in my notes the story that Ganja tells about her mother, where she says her mother would always tell her that she was beautiful and she hated it because it was something that her mother liked about her and she hated her mother. And I was sort of thinking that her mother was kind of a stand-in for some sort of oppressive figure like white people. It was like there was this one thing that the oppressor likes about you and you start to hate it because you hate them so much. And then it was also, in that speech, she talks about how her mother treated her as a disease, and eventually she started to believe that narrative, and so she started to fulfill the narrative of being a disease to her. And I thought that was a way of somebody sort of fulfilling the prophecy of internalized racism and having that foisted upon them constantly in society, where white culture will treat black people as though they're some sort of disease to be dealt with in society.
I think that's a good point. Solid.
I was torn on how to feel about that scene, because on the one hand, I sort of hate that writing device where someone is just like, let me tell you a story of something that happened to me a long time ago, and eventually it's going to relate back to what's going on right now, like, essentially unprompted, like it's kind of like an Oscar moment. But then I like the story in a lot of ways. Did anyone else think that she was talking about a sexual assault that she didn't want to admit, or was that just me who was thinking that that's what happened? She comes home and she's like, I was in a snowball fight, and her mom's like, don't lie to me, you're a slut. And I was like,
I didn't even think about that.
I thought it was more just like the, I don't know, I mean, a little bit of thinking of the idea of oppression and just the ways in which, I don't know, like, maybe children aren't allowed to have innocent things, like, that there's always a suspicion that something more insidious is going on once you reach a certain age, especially for women, that, like, you can't be out because being out is about, you know, doing something illicit, and that taints you in some way, but...
That makes sense.
Your reading makes sense too.
Yeah, and that you don't have your own story, that someone else always decides who you actually are. You don't get to decide who you are. So if your mom decides that she thinks that her daughter is being this way, that's her daughter being this way. She does not get to determine her own story.
It's building on internalized racism. Probably the most obvious scene about that is when Ganja and Hess are having breakfast, and Hess is treating Archie, the butler, really badly, and it seems like, especially because he's, like, darker skinned than she is, and, like, as soon as she's, like, offered this role of sort of being, like, a white middle-class person, like, she steps into it immediately and just starts treating everyone lower than her badly.
Are you talking about Ganja?
Yeah, Ganja's treating him badly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hess is the man.
You mixed up Ganja and Hess. That's cool, though.
it's weird that he's the main character, but he's the second name in the...
Yeah. The titular Ganja doesn't appear until, like, almost an hour into the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of thought, is the title supposed to be a play on, like, Porgy and Bess? I kind of thought maybe that was what it was getting at, like the sort of classic.
Maybe.
I don't know what that is.
Black.
It's a play.
It's a musical about black people written by a white person. So I'm not sure if there is a significance to that, where it's sort of like, this is, you know, it's a play, or it's a musical about, you know, I guess what white people think black people do, sort of like showing really what black people are like or something like that.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, it seems like, I for one thing, obviously Bill Gunn has like a huge theatrical background, so
mm-hmm.
I looked that up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also thought the images that they show, where they sort of show the same scene twice, but they show it with different costumes on people. One time it's a man sort of coming into a lobby and shooting. I'm trying to remember who shoots who. I can't remember who does the shooting in that scene. But then they show it again, and the characters are wearing masks. And all the white characters are shown sort of in flashes wearing those masks and kind of laughing. And then you also see Hess wearing the mask as well. And so I just assumed that there was something to that, as it being like him being kind of controlled by this white background, this sort of white elite. Because there is one point in the film where he goes to see... a white woman who I'm assuming is a prostitute, but she's very poor, obviously. And then he he kills her by drinking her blood as well. So I think it was saying that not only is what he doing hurting other black people, but it's also hurting other poor people, just poor people in general. And it's all about sort of the upper class controlling the lower class via these, I don't know, like conduits like this. Like this internalized racism actually not only hurts black people, but it also hurts poor white people as well.
Yeah.
I thought that scene was really unsettling, where he just like looks at the baby as he's walking out, yeah, and just like crying.
Yeah.
It makes the, I'm sure it's a stock sound effect, but it makes the Aaliyah, are you that somebody baby noise? Which I will always associate with that baby noise. What? I thought it was weird that she's walking the street with her baby in hand, like as if that's part of the seduction.
That's also a throwback to Barry Lyndon.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. This is pretty much, you know, the 70s exploitation Barry Lyndon.
Seems about right. Repeated musical motifs too.
Yeah, that's true.
Although not nearly as funny in this one.
So what did you think about like the so Patrick, you already mentioned that you really like the Reverend character. What did you think about the relationship between Hess and religion, or the how religion was used in general in this movie?
I wasn't really certain what Bill Gunn's stance was exactly on religion, although I felt like maybe he was positing it as a positive thing for black people because of the way that it sort of, I feel like him going and having the whatever he says, the shadow of the cross on his heart, and you know, being released of the curse, I felt like that was a positive thing for that character. Even though he dies, he's sort of freed of having to be a vampire and drain other people for the rest of his life. And so in a way, it was sort of similar to what happens at the end of God of Thunder. I guess spoiler alert for God of Thunder, but it's a person sacrificing themselves so that they can no longer be used by the system. And I actually wrote in my notes that God sets Hess free from the eternal prison of whiteness. There was
I feel like I had the same interpretation, except that the opposite. I thought it was sort of nihilistic, and that, you know, at this point in time, there's no escape. You're just stuck with horrible white culture, and it's just going to destroy you, and then you're dead. Like, because of Christianity being, you know, predominantly white, at least at that point, religion in America, it seems weird that that would be able to save him from whiteness, that, like, whiteness could save him from whiteness. But,
yeah.
I don't know.
I almost think, though, that he's sort of saying that black people have sort of co-opted Christianity to be their own thing now. Like, they've taken it and made it their own from what it was to white people, because it's certainly, you know, the way you see the people praising and worshiping in that is certainly not indicative of the way most white culture worships Christianity. Like, it's usually a very stoic, you know, solemn thing with white people.
Well,
and I think it's that black people have sort of made it their own, so it's a way that they've taken back from some of white culture.
I think that it was pretty telling that the Reverend was also Hess's driver, because I think that that says a lot about how Bill Gunn sees religion and how it's being mostly used as in service of, well, in this case, the rich. So Hess gets to basically, you can say that he's cursed, but he also gets to live out this life basically how he wants to. And then when he feels like being like rid of all his sins, he just goes to the church and is rid of it. And it basically just does whatever, you know, he asks it to. It's like, it serves him way more than he serves it. And so, whereas the other people in the church, like, they get to, maybe in a way, like, pretend that they're having their sins washed away, he actually has them. He's like scourged of all his wrongdoings. And so in a way, I feel like this movie's pretty critical of religion in that way.
It's possible.
But yeah.
Ruben? You're the only one who hasn't weighed in on this Jesus talk.
I didn't notice that Hess died at the end.
Yeah. I mean, I don't remember it being super explicit, but he goes, you know, up to the cross, and I guess died isn't the right word, because I guess technically he's already dead if he's a vampire, but he is. I forget exactly how they put it, but they say if the shadow of the cross covers your heart, you are, you know, freed of the eternal scourge of having to be a vampire forever, having to live forever with the curse, basically. So I took that to mean, you know, he dies a vampire death, whatever that may be.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the religion is, you know, a double consciousness thing, which I kind of mentioned before, like the idea that of being pulled into like a, the idea of like being right, being Christian in this movie, and the idea of being like wrong, being like his, you know, native African religion, and the idea of like blood sacrifice versus metaphorical blood sacrifice. You know, that the idea that he can't be a good person in this world because of the way in which white society has already, you know, a priori defined him as bad.
That makes sense.
And him sacrificing being a vampire is, you know, him trying to fit into white society, and it involves a sort of death.
I didn't think of it that way. I didn't think of it that way, but I can certainly see that as another reading of the way that the ending. What did everybody think about the naked running?
At the end?
Yeah, the naked running. I think it's, is that supposed to be Maida?
No, I don't think so. At the man who runs towards Ganja at the end, I think.
Is it Hess?
Nope, I don't think so.
No, it's not Hess because he had like the big beard.
That's what I was thinking. I was just, like, I don't remember Hess having a beard, and I was like, is that supposed to be Maida? But it didn't seem like it was Maida either. It's just a man running, naked and free, through her garden. And I wasn't sure the significance of that, but
me either.
I could not speculate.
At the very end, it sort of freeze frames when he jumps over what looks like Hess's dead body.
Yeah,
but
it was very strange, but I kind of liked it because I was like, oh, this is kind of uncomfortable having to look at another man's like swinging junk as he's running. But then I was like, I guess that's the point.
Isn't it from Ganja's perspective though, anyway? So from her perspective, this should be pretty okay.
I guess she seems
all right with it, yeah. She's smiling at the end, so.
Yeah.
She certainly seems to be enjoying
it. She seems pretty happy.
Um,
we talked about it earlier.
He comes out of he climbs out of the water, out of the pool.
Purification.
Yes.
We mentioned it briefly before, but their marriage is one of the things that I really liked in terms of how weirdly it just sort of defied, like, traditional narrative expectation, because it's basically just like she tells that horrible story of her childhood, and then it cuts to them laughing and running around, and then it cuts to them getting married. Like, it's just like three very short scenes, and they go from like a really traumatic situation to them being in love, sort of. And it was,
that's after she discovers Maida in the fridge, right?
Yeah. After she discovers her husband murdered in a fridge.
Pretty cool too,
Although he wasn't technically murdered, he killed himself.
That's true.
I guess she doesn't know that.
Right.
I was so lost for most of the beginning of the movie, because it seemed like the preacher was going to be kind of the narrator who was guiding us through the story, but then he disappears for like over an hour.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how to, like, if there's some kind of intentionality to that, but it was extremely hard for me to orient myself in this movie for the first, like, 30 minutes. I was like, who's the vampire now? Which one's addicted to the blood? Where'd that preacher go?
Yeah, I was also lost at the beginning. And through the whole first section, which I believe is called Victim, I was kind of wondering, I was like, what is this movie on about already? And then it gets to the second part, and I can't remember what that part is called. It's had something to do with like assimilating or conforming or something like that. And then it starts to show, okay, here's his son who speaks French, and you know, here's how rich he is, and here's, you know, what an upstanding guy he is. And I was like, this movie, I'm more into this, but it's also a much like more, I don't know, like westernized white ideal society that he's dealing with in that part. And I was like, that makes me uncomfortable with myself now, because like all of a sudden there's all of these signifiers of white culture and I'm super okay with what's happening. And I'm like, that makes me uncomfortable. And then we get the surviving section where he's, you know, with a prostitute and the pimp tries to kill him and he ends up killing the pimp instead. And that scene, you know, felt more like typical blaxploitation. And I was like, okay, this also makes me uncomfortable that I could follow this, and I'm like really way more familiar with this narrative where it's like, oh, he got the better of the guy who was trying to kill him because he's a super-powered vampire.
Although even the scene like right before that is so weird with the woman hitting on him in the bar. She's like walking back and forth in front of the frame and telling him this really weird story about like this child who lives in her building who's like strung out on drugs, and I was like, this is the weirdest way to hit on a person ever.
Yeah, the movie kept doing that. It kept switching gears and showing you, I guess, what was sort of a traditional narrative that you would understand, and kind of commenting on why you thought you understood what you understood about that narrative.
I mean,
that was what I liked about those scenes, the way they kept changing like that, where it was like, all right, now how about this thing? Do you recognize this? Do you, you know, how do you feel about this?
It was also different perspectives. So it wasn't really told throughout one character's perspective throughout the whole movie. It kept switching between different ones. And which I thought was very interesting, because like the scene between Ganja and Hess's butler. All those scenes had like a completely different feel to them, if you compare them to the scenes involving Hess himself or the preacher, which it's almost like pretty much every time the movie had other characters at the middle of the scenes, it switched perspectives completely, and it was about something different. So in a way, you could say that Gunn was kind of trying to get at, like, different aspects of, I guess you could say, black experience in the 70s. And Hess represented parts of them, and Ganja represented parts of them, and Preacher represented other parts. And, you know, Archie, the butler, represented another part of it. And basically all of them in conflict with each other kind of resulted in, like, trying to get at all the different texts informing black identity.
That makes sense. Yeah, I can see that. It's.
I found out who that guy at the end was, by the way.
Who is he?
There earlier, Ganja and Hess are having like a candlelight dinner, with him. And then,
oh, it's that guy.
Okay. Yeah, I remember him now.
And then yes. Ganja has sex with him, and I guess she turns him into a vampire since there's like all this blood.
Right.
Is it the same guy that they put in the that they leave outside, and she says he's still alive? Is that the guy
they leave in the field? Yes. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I completely forgot about that guy, but yes.
So, yeah, he's, I guess, being reanimated as a vampire then, and she's happy
he's
to...
the new Hess.
He's
the new,
yeah.
She's happy to see
taking
him.
Hess's place, yeah.
Mm.
Maybe that's what Archie means by he came with the house. The house just keeps getting transferred owners by different vampires murdering other vampires.
Is Archie a vampire? I guess
him saying that is probably also... the kind of what Archie kind of represents.
Sure, of course.
But yeah, for sure. I actually like the way, so the scenes when she's being so terrible to him, I felt like the movie was not strictly making the point, Ganja is a terrible person. Like the way in which she was like trying to make him angry or aggressive is like she was trying to provoke an honest reaction from him to his situation. Like, well, why should you feel happy serving food to this pretentious, rich person who pretends to have an honest relationship with you? Why aren't you actually angry to be doing this? Why are you doing this in the first place? And I mean, I think Archie being black is a pretty important part of what Gunn was trying to maybe say about class relations and things like that.
That goes back to that thing she said about only liking impolite questions, that she's constantly trying to provoke people because it's weird how complacent they are.
Yeah.
I think that's a better reading than my initial one was. I was like, wow, she's super rude. Like the grocery store thing, I was like, damn, that's some cold shit.
Oh yeah, the bags. Yes. That was like the moment where I was like, well, either this movie's just saying, hey, look at how terrible people can be to poor servant staff. Or it was like, well, I mean, she probably, the way she's portrayed is she knows a lot about what it feels like to be oppressed. So in a way, it's like her trying to level with Archie in a way that's like, well, this is actually what you're supposed to do here. You're supposed to pretend that you're fine with doing all these horrible tasks, and you're never supposed to complain. So let's see how.
Why do you do that?
Let's see how far I can actually bring you before you start getting angry.
She's trolling him.
She's like what Basil and Ruben. I don't know if Patrick's watched it yet, but it seems like what you felt, how you felt about Selma, is you wanted it to be more angry.
Mm.
That's like how she felt about Archie.
That makes sense.
I have a note that says that woman takes her, the prostitute takes her wig off to reveal her black hair, and then there's some other stuff with black hair at the end, more about white colonization of black bodies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote that down too. I was like, well, that's a real surprising hair reveal. I feel like that's an interesting dynamic too, that I feel like if part of the point is presenting yourself in a seductive thing, that she like takes the wig off halfway through the process, and then they try to murder him.
Yeah. So apparently Spike,
that's what it gets though for falling for that weird I have a strung out child routine.
Apparently Spike Lee has tried to remake this movie, or actually has remade.
Yeah, it's coming out this year. I'm excited.
Oh, wow.
The Sweet Blood of Jesus.
Yes. Which I'm really... Yeah, that will be pretty interesting. It stars Snoop from The Wire.
I'll take it.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's the movie he got made on Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
It's online now. I'm actually super tempted to watch it right away, but I'm hoping it'll come to theaters in Portland and I can see it that way. But yeah, you can rent it through like Vimeo, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So if anyone wants some more ganja and Hess action, you can check out Spike Lee's rendition.
Nice.
I'm hoping since he got all the money from Kickstarter, I'll be back to like super angry Spike Lee.
Yeah.
That's my favorite.
I don't have anything else to say about this movie.
Yeah, I've exhausted my notes on it.
I wrote a lot of notes, but they're all kind of the same notes. I meant to say earlier that I feel like it's so rare that I can see a movie where I'm like, this is a weird movie. And I feel like this was an actually weird movie.
Yeah.
Not like what people usually say. I was like, sure. I have no idea where this movie is going.
And I kept having no idea where this movie was going throughout. Like, there was never a point at which, like, oh, this is how this movie rolls. Like, this is how it works. Nope. It's kept changing. Yeah. Another thing I wanted to say is that I really thought the sex scenes were pretty great. I thought they were really some really beautiful people looking really beautiful together. And if anything, because we talked about the potentially exploitative part of this movie, I never felt like those sex scenes were just there to fetishize black bodies. But I still thought that they managed to be really, really hot in a way, and probably not that hard since the actors involved are all really good looking. And it's a shame that neither Dwayne Jones, who was in Night of the Living Dead, but that was like 5 years before this and wasn't really in much stuff since then, or Marlene Clark really made a big dent in Hollywood or anything, because there's pretty great actors and pretty great looking people, and just watching
Bill
them
Gunn either. Well,
yeah, Bill Gunn, yeah, I mean, he was on the
cut. I mean, I guess he was doing his theater stuff and he wrote a couple novels, but yeah. I looked up his filmography and he only made 3 movies, and this is the only one that's like viewable. Some other one has never had any kind of actual release,
and yeah, stop,
museums have been the only places that have ever screened it. Mm-hmm. And then his movie that he made 7 years after this in 1980, I forget the name of that one, also seems like it's never had any real release because it only has like 3 or 4 votes on IMDb rating it, so
yeah.
It must be extremely hard to see.
He also wrote this movie for Hal Ashby called The Landlord.
I've seen that. That movie's good. It's
mm-hmm.
It's also a movie that's sort of hard to pin down, but it's pretty interesting. About gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
That's one I'd actually like to rewatch again, because I watched it once a while back, but I wasn't giving it as full attention as I felt like I should have.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Okay.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And please go on iTunes and subscribe. Give us a 5-star rating and write a nice review. And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.